From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The coronavirus pandemic brought new attention to the role of low-wage labor in the United States. While most Americans were quick to praise the courage of so-called essential workers and call them heroes, few questioned why those working to keep us alive and fed were not earning more. Fewer still linked the poor state of labor rights in the U.S. to the waning power of unions. Now, a new book has issued a fierce call for workers to understand the limits of organizing under existing models and laws, and demands a new way of thinking about union organizing, how to expand unions, and make them more politically powerful. Sean Richman is the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Sean spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. He's the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at the SUNY Empire State College. He's written for a number of publications, including The American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin, The New York Daily News, and The New York Times. Welcome to the program, Sean.
Thanks for coming back.
So first, what is, how do you explain the limits of how our unions are set up currently and how organized labor is set up? You point out in your book that a majority of Americans who are workers wish they were in unions, and yet something like 10 or 11% are actually in unions. So there's a clear disconnect between the desire of workers to be unionized and their and actual unionization. Why?
Yeah, something like 60% of workers would like to be in a union, and 90% of workers who are in a union would vote to stay in that union. So unions are actually very popular, but our system is broken. Our labor law system is completely broken. Partly it is the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, but largely it is a series of really horrible court decisions dating back to 1938. That have really restrained and restricted, A, what a union can bargain over, that has created a system of rules that are, I think, if you step back and you look at it as a reasonable, rational person, plainly unconstitutional, plainly a violation of people's First Amendment rights, their Fifth Amendment rights, their 13th Amendment rights. So it's incredibly difficult to form a union. And then employers have spent 50 years seceding from the system, offshoring jobs, subcontracting jobs, the gig economy, turning everybody into a freelancer. That's all a strategy of getting out of the way that the law was designed to basically have these large corporations at the time, GM, Ford, and U.S. Steel, and sort of place a union across that entire corporation. But the workplace has been incredibly fissured, and it's all by design. It's by employers not wanting to really deal with their, treat their workers with any degree of respect or legal obligation.
So there are several issues that you discuss in your book. One, which is how those existing unions that have had, you know, some measure of success in expanding their unions somewhat could do better, and how those unions that have had some political influence could do better. But then there's all these laws, these Supreme Court legal precedents. Is it an issue of which is a better tactic to approach changing laws versus unions approaching things differently, or is it something that really needs to be approached on multiple fronts, because the state of labor organizing and power in the U.S. is quite pitiful, especially compared to other industrialized nations?
It's absolutely multiple fronts. My book is a little bit of a Frankenstein's monster because it's got multiple audiences in mind. Like, there's, 200 or 300 people on Capitol Hill that I really need to read this book. And get some ideas of what the actual legal changes should be. The current standard bearer legislative reform is this thing called the PRO Act, which would mostly overturn Taft-Hartley. Joe Biden says he would sign it. You know, most Democratic senators and representatives say they would vote for it. It's a good bill. We're in such a rapidly changing situation that it ain't good enough. I mean, yes, let's pass the PRO Act, but also we need like 27 other bills. We need a just cause law, which is sort of a right to your job law that you can't just be fired for no reason or a bad reason even. We need to put a structure of workplace governance in every workplace in America that's separate and distinct from the union. Germany does this through works councils. We did this briefly in the first couple of years of the New Deal with the National Recovery Administration, where we had these sort of industrial, just in, across entire sectors, labor codes that were getting set, and unions were at the table, or workers' representatives were at the table. We need stuff like that to sort of affect this. But also, there's definitely some strategic considerations that unions, and more importantly, that the left need to have in regards to how we take our complaints about everything. And I'm mad about everything. I don't know about you. I'm mad about everything.
Yes, happening. I'm a journalist. Therefore, I am mad about everything.
we got to take those grievances to the workplace. You know, the current state of labor law is it's illegal to do the things we got to do, and the law is not, it's very uneven. An employer that breaks labor law gets a slap on the wrist 3 years from now. A union that breaks labor law, you know, a couple years ago, Nabisco shut down an Oreo factory in Chicago, and they were going to ship all the jobs out of the country, and the workers in Chicago, they want to go on strike. And the reasonable thing for unions to do at that point would be for the grocery store workers, who are largely unionized, to say, you know what, the next time a Nabisco truck shows up to our store, we're not letting the boxes off. We're not putting Oreos on our shelf. No scab Oreos. That would be devastating, which is why it's completely illegal. Not only is it illegal, but the employer would be able to go directly to the federal courts and directly sue the union for triple damages, and they could just make up whatever the damages they are. So obviously they would claim billions, and the United Food and Commercial Workers would go out of business immediately.
So the laws are written to give huge preference to bosses over workers. It's designed to be this way, or to paraphrase Bernie Sanders, the system is rigged.
Yeah, I mean, and think about how many times you've turned on the TV and you've gotten like a blackout notice of like, you know, call this CEO at this cable company or this network if you want to see NBA, you know, basketball, if you want to see the final season of Mad Men on AMC. And that is two corporations fighting with each other and holding you as a third party ransom. They can do it, perfectly legal. Unions trying to take a dispute to a third party or a second party, you get fined. You know, crippling damages.
So what about the National Labor Relations Board? I mean, you know, corporations are the Chamber of Commerce, and of course the entire, which is not a government entity, but they have a very powerful lobby presence. Unions and organized labor does try to have a lobbying presence, but in terms of just government agencies that are supposed to advocate for workers in the government, is the National Labor Relations Board all we have? And if so, how flawed is it?
It's not all we have, because we have the Occupational Safety Health Administration, OSHA. We have the Department of Labor, we have the Mine Safety Health Administration. There's other places. But when you have a Republican president, every federal administration that's supposed to protect workers turns into an anti-worker organization, like as quickly as possible, as soon as the Democrats start getting term limited out.
And that's happened clearly under Trump.
It happened under Trump, but it happened under Bush. It happened under the other Bush. It happened under Reagan. There's nothing, not a single thing that this NLRB is doing that Mitt Romney wouldn't have done, that John McCain wouldn't have done.
I see.
There is an entire cottage industry of right-wing think tanks that spend every minute that they're out of power, every minute of the Obama administration, every minute of the Clinton administration, planning for how they're going to screw us on day one. And we don't have anywhere near a sort of a common, you know, a parallel approach. Partly it's Democrats' inability to sort of do some forward thinking. Partly it's Democrats and union leaders, it's our sort of wanting things to return to a normal that's never going to come back. So we don't want to bend the rules in our favor in the way that they will do, you know, before they're even in office. So those are real problems. I mean, the NLRB is totally underfunded. It is absolutely handcuffed and crippled by 80 years of terrible Supreme Court decisions.
The right has gone on offensive pretty amazingly using their model of state by state legislation, most notably the so-called right to work laws, which over just a few years spread to more than half the states in the nation and further crippled unions, right?
So there's this rule that like federal laws trump, forgive the pun, state laws. The carve-out within labor law is right to work. Hmm. It's the one section of the federal labor law that says, you know what, states get to make their own rule. And you're right. The Koch brothers, starting when Obama got elected, decided, oh, the way that we win is we kill the unions in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Ohio. Hey, those are the states that Trump won that gave him, you know, pushed him over the edge in the Electoral College. And I think that the left or the liberal left, unions and our allies actually need to grapple with the question of federal supremacy. We're afraid to touch it because things would be so much worse if there were more carve-outs in the federal law. Because you would see Mississippi would just, they would reestablish slavery if they could, right? And it's only because we have federal laws that stop them from doing it that they can't do it. And one of the frustrating things is in states like Illinois, in New York, in Chicago, in Washington, we have pretty good state legislatures and halfway decent governors that you know, we could get some really good laws that would enable us to organize really effectively. But the trade-off would be, we go up in New York and we reestablish slavery in Mississippi. And it's a thing that we grapple with. And I think it's one of the questions that's really on the table about, if the Democrats regain the Senate, regain the White House and hold on to the House of Representatives, you know, we need to move some real laws fast.
Right. And unfortunately, when the Democrats have controlled all three branches of government, they haven't pushed the limits of their power nearly as much as Republicans do. And Republicans, even when they just hold two out of the three branches of power, tend to get so much more accomplished because they tend to be relentless, throw aside precedent and ethics and traditions and even laws and rewrite laws. I mean, they do what it takes.
Yeah. And Democrats are still, you know, I mean, the Democrats, right? The problem is like there's no Democratic Party. There's all of these sort of stakeholders and it's all very mixed up. We definitely have a sort of a beltway problem with the think tanks and the international unions and the members of Congress, that there is definitely a groupthink that has set in. I wrote my book because I'm not in Washington. I'm here on Staten Island. I wanted to shoot my way into some conversations that are really necessary. And there are real considerations about the norms are gone. The question is, how do we put money in workers' pockets right away? How do we give workers real power and protections so that unions can get back to significant levels of density and unions can do what Democrats need them to do, which is that the Democrats don't lose the 2022 midterms because they dithered on these really essential questions of workplace democracy.
So what can unions do now? You know, and you refer in your book, I mean, you've been a union organizer, so you know intimately how different unions have taken different approaches over the years, SEIU and the American Federation of Teachers, et cetera. Are there some lessons that that you draw from what unions have done successfully that could be applied across other unions?
So again, my book is a Frankenstein's monster, so it's addressed to multiple audiences. Aside from those 300 people in Washington I want to talk to, I want to talk to every rank and file member of Democratic Socialists of America. I think that moving forward is going to depend a lot more upon rank and file activists strategically figure out ways to, frankly, break the law, probably in non-union settings. You know, and so that might be sabotage. That might be, you know, it's work to rule
civil
action.
Disobedience?
Civil disobedience, you know, all kinds of, like, I don't know what a job action looks like at Google or at Amazon exactly. I've got some ideas in the book. I think, you know, the workers know way better than I do. But that's sort of where we need to be. And the law is so messed up right now that we'd almost be in worse shape if the workers at Amazon started forming NLRB certified unions, because
really?
Then they would be prevented from doing the things that they need to do to actually get Bezos's attention. For the unions, the main thing I'm trying to argue, I think, in my book, is the lawyers in DC, both on staff at the international unions and in the law firms on retainer, have been engaging in a very cautious strategy. And I totally understand why. The courts are not our friends. And so the strategy is basically like, let's not take this question to the courts because who knows how they'll rule, and maybe somehow they'll figure out a way to repeal the 13th Amendment. And that is a strategy for winning or losing slowly, rather than, you know, I mean, there are stakes here. And so one of the arguments that I'm making is, again, if you step back from the labor law, just the full weight of the system, take the example of what a union certification election is at the National Labor Relations Board. This is an arm of the federal government that is conducting an election that the people are voting on that's gonna grant additional regulatory privileges and protections to the voters. And the rules of the election are such that one party and one party only can mandate that every voter has to attend a presentation of their position or they'll be fired. And crucially, within that presentation, they can lie. They can hire somebody to impersonate a representative of the federal government, which 10% of all employers do.
Wow.
They can basically threaten your job. And crucially, again, one party, but only an employer, and only employer that advocates a no vote. Because if an employer conducted a mandatory meeting and said, hey, we actually think a union's a good idea, that would also be illegal. When you step back from that, how is that not politically coerced speech, right? The whole issue at the center of the Janus case. How is that not a massive First Amendment violation?
So
and
is
I think
this,
that one
this...
of the problems is we all got to step back and get out of Washington D.C. and start making these arguments that the full weight of labor law has become just totally so unconstitutional that it stinks to high heaven.
So obviously taking legal cases to the Supreme Court is a risky prospect given the makeup of the Supreme Court. And that's in fact where we've had losses. So in the absence of that congressional action, legislation is really what's needed, right? So right now the Democrats control the House. There is a good chance they may control the White House and possibly the Senate. And if that is the case, that sort of progressive legislation that brushes aside so many of these anti-labor Supreme Court decisions could be what frees up at least the framework for unionizing to happen on a mass scale, right? And I imagine that the conditions are ripe given our historic inequality that we're experiencing today, the massive transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top during this pandemic, exacerbated even more during this pandemic.
The Supreme Court has no appropriate role within labor law. And so every bad Supreme Court decision on labor law can be legislatively overturned. And I do think that we need a progressive strategy for how we draft laws that tell these right-wing judges, back off, stay in your lane.
Yeah.
And we've got a very narrow window for passing anything. And I'm not the sort of Pollyanna who thinks that the Congress or that President Biden are somehow going to be our savior. But I do think also that the left, we tell ourselves some very disempowering narratives about how the law works. You know, that there won't be any change unless there's a general strike, you know, and so we should focus on the general strike and not on what the law should say. No, I mean, if we focus on the general strike, then somebody else is going to pass the laws and they're going to suck. We should focus on what the law says and on how to get the general strike. But also, we misremember key lessons of the New Deal. The New Deal didn't just come out all of a sudden whole cloth. President Roosevelt's initial approach was pro-corporate, not pro-worker. First couple of years, he was trying to pass laws that would allow corporations to get around anti-monopoly laws, to collude over prices, and he only dealt unions in on the question because he just didn't need one more person to oppose his agenda, because his agenda was not very popular. And so the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, which, it allowed corporations to collude over prices, but it did create this process for labor codes. And it said, well, there should be worker representatives within that. And it had this section in the law, Section 7A, that said, you have a right to organize as a union. Wasn't worth the paper it was written on. No enforcement mechanism for it whatsoever. But it was just enough to raise workers' hopes and expectations and then dash them. And it is directly responsible for a strike wave in 1934 that is really what's responsible for us getting the National Labor Relations Act and for getting a Supreme Court that never wanted to let this stuff happen say it was constitutional.
Wow.
So there's a dialectic there. You know, Joe Biden is not going to give us enough of what we need. And we all got to get back to work so we can all go on strike and put pressure on whoever our next president is.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much, Sean, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sean Richman. He has been a union organizer and representative, program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at the SUNY Empire State College. And we've been talking about his new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.